This show is a Hopful Media podcast production. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 123, Fever Pitch. Time is running out, so please, please, please send me those questions for the episode 125 AMA. I will keep taking questions right up to the moment we record that episode, but that clock is officially ticking. Email historyofpersiapodcast@gmail.com, message me on social media, send a carrier pigeon, have a Greek messenger sprint across rough terrain like the Persians have just invaded Marathon. Just get those questions in. All right. Let's review. Last time, we talked about Alexander the Great's extended family and sex life, which, unusually for this show, did not overlap. Before that, I talked about how Alexander was preparing to invade Arabia in June of 323, how he orchestrated a gigantic wedding at Susa, and how he mourned the death of Hephaestion. Before that, I talked about the voyage of Nearchus in the Indian Ocean and how Alexander's crossing of the Gedrosian Desert exacted a brutal toll as they left their conquered Indian territories behind. King Alexander of Macedon, Lord of all Asia, has been a very busy conqueror for these last 18 or so episodes. But now, I briefly want everyone to cast their memories back to episodes 113 and 14, the Battle of Gaugamela and Alexander's seizure of Babylon. Gaugamela coincided with a lunar eclipse, a great big omen in the sky to many ancient societies, including the Greeks and Babylonians. In their state of war, the Babylonian priesthood warned that this was a sign that the king could not enter Babylon. Well, Darius III had no intention of being in Babylon at the time because he was hoping to be reconquering his Western Empire. Of course, that plan did not work out, and Alexander marched right into the city, declaring himself their new king. The priests of Marduk warned the conqueror about their omens and prophecy, and said to appease their god, Alexander should renovate the Esagila, Marduk's great temple at the heart of the city. Alexander started preparing to give the order, but his own Greek soothsayers and oracles denied the Babylonian claim and said it was all a plot to con Alexander out of his money. Well, fast forward to early 323, and Alexander the Great was really starting to feel like he had offended some sort of god. Supposedly, an Indian philosopher the Greeks called Kalanos traveled to Susa with the army before dramatically self-immolating and giving Alexander a parting message. "We shall meet again in Babylon," apparently a portent of the king's death. Maybe completely fictitious, maybe just not a very dramatic prediction, if you consider that Alexander was still recovering from recently being impaled and crossing the desert, but to Alexander the Great, this was supposedly still worrying. So Alex drew up plans to level the whole ziggurat and rebuild the Esagila from scratch in the most dramatic renovation Babylon had seen in centuries. Work actually began on this project, and archaeologists can identify a distinct layer of debris from when Alexander ordered 20,000 soldiers to tear the temple down and start from scratch. In May of 323, while Alexander was out of the palace for a day, an escaped prisoner slipped into the throne room, donned Alexander's diadem, and sat on the throne in the king's sacred place. This man, predictably, was detained once again and executed for his stunt. Alexander's Greek advisors took this as a bad omen, but one theory suggests that the Babylonian clergy were actually in on the whole escapade. There is not much direct evidence for it in Babylonian history specifically, but other ancient West Asian cultures practiced ceremonial scapegoating. When a prophecy foretold doom to the king, a prisoner, peasant, or some other person of less political importance would ceremonially be king for the day to act as a scapegoat for the real king's prophecy. Then he would be executed, hypothetically manipulating circumstances so that a king died as predicted, but not the actual ruler. One theory is that the Babylonian priests orchestrated this whole thing to give Alexander a scapegoat. If that's true, it probably wasn't worth the effort. By June, Alexander was increasingly irritable and paranoid. He had lost his closest friend, suffered many betrayals by men he had known and relied on all his life, and his body was crisscrossed with the scars of multiple wounds incurred during his conquest, not to mention whatever internal damage was done by the new and exciting diseases he must have encountered over the preceding decade. A few days into the months, Alexander started feeling sick after a heavy drinking session. But this escalated quickly to being entirely bedridden. However, it is still one of those very same Babylonian priests who watched the skies for omens in the course of the sun and moon and stars that provides our single contemporary account of what happened next. This priest, anonymous in the style of Babylonian writing at the time, was watching the skies early on the evening of the 29th day of the month of Ajaru, in the 14th year of King Alexander, using inclusive counting, aka June 11th, 323 BCE. As our priest looked up, lamenting that there was too much cloud coverage to make any good observations, a great commotion broke out in the palace. From his rooftop vantage point, our anonymous astronomer might have been able to see soldiers running around the city and messengers crisscrossing the ancient metropolis. Before long, bells began to toll, and eventually news reached this temple observatory. The astronomer jotted down a simple note about that evening's observations on a clay tablet that has survived for over 2,300 years. The day of the 29th, the king died, clouds. Plutarch says that the Macedonian royal diaries placed this around the 9th hour of daylight, somewhere between 3 and 6 p.m. Alexander the Great, conqueror of the Persian Empire, started fading from consciousness, and his guards gathered their king's closest companions and advisors. He was 33 years old, just over a month shy of his 34th birthday. Alexander had been king of Macedon for 13 years, lord of all Asia for 10 years, pharaoh of Egypt for 9. He was the son of the great god Zeus Ammon, and conqueror of the last king of kings, surpassing even the Kashiathea Kashiathianam. And it is here that our usual cast of Alexandrian sources has to narrow even further. Plutarch's Life of Alexander and Arrian's Anabasis Alexandri are strict biographies and end at the king's death, leaving us primarily with Curtius and Diodorus to deal with the aftermath, filling in bits of references from sources like Justin. And after this episode, you better get really friendly with Diodorus Siculus and Justin, because they are basically all we've got for the narrative for about the next 60 years of history. As his voice faded away for the last time, Alexander muttered something that history would record forever after as the words toi krastistoi. At its core, this is the Greek word kratos, meaning strength or power. Also, not coincidentally, the name of the protagonist in the God of War series. And through the bizarre magic of linguistics, it's actually related to the English word hard. Istos is the ancient Greek equivalent to ist. So, kratistos is the strongest. And since grammar is conveyed through inflection, the oi ending in this case indicates direction. Alexander's last words were supposedly, to the strongest. Seemingly willing his empire to whoever could take it by force. Except, Kratos is also the root word for the name Craterus, one of Alexander's close friends and best generals. And these were the slurred words of a dying man. So there is a valid interpretation that Alexander was trying to declare Craterus as either his successor or at least regent until the son potentially waiting to be born from Roxane came of age. That would make a lot of sense, seeing as Alexander had just sent Craterus back to Macedon to take over as regent. It's also entirely possible that this story was made up to justify the actions of Alexander's generals. The only clear decision in those final moments was that Alexander handed his signet ring to Perdiccas, allowing him to act as de facto leader of the empire in Babylon for the time being. As word spread through the city that Alexander was dead, a multicultural mourning period erupted, as Iranian, Mesopotamian, Elamite, Syrian, Phoenician, Egyptian, and Greek people all began to grieve in their own way. This might sound odd if you were expecting Alexander to still be treated as a conqueror, but he took Babylon almost 8 years ago. He was the king, and more importantly, his army was still around. So public mourning was the order of the day. That doesn't mean that rebellion wasn't a concern, though. Babylonian guards and Macedonian soldiers alike spent that first night out in force to keep watch over the city and prevent any dissent from rising above murmurs in the street. While the city officially mourned the passing of a great king under guard, Alexander's bodyguards, generals, and advisors were embroiled in an increasingly heated debate up in the palace. Many of the middling and low-ranking officers couldn't even get inside because so many soldiers had gathered at the doors awaiting the outcome of these arguments. Who would succeed to the throne? Who would inherit Macedon's sprawling new empire? Were all of these famed generals about to murder one another? This was all very up in the air the moment Alexander's body went limp. And those are all questions we will answer after this break. I routinely wish that I knew more languages. Even right in the middle of the US, I run into Spanish speakers all the time, and my social media always has a little Persian, Arabic, some Dutch, and German. Rosetta Stone does help. It's the most trusted language learning program, after all. It's also conveniently available on desktop or on the go as an app, and has some really cool features that truly immerse you in the language you're learning. Just the first steps, like learning a new alphabet and some simple phrases, helped open new doors, and Rosetta Stone is a great choice as the trusted expert in this for 30 years and millions of users with 25 languages available to learn. They focus on fast language acquisition, without English translations to help you learn, speak, listen, and think in your new language while building long-term retention. Their true accent speech recognition also gives feedback on pronunciation, which can be really important for languages like Persian, where how you say something is very important. And on top of being available for desktop and mobile, you have the option to download lessons and take them offline. This is also all available at a steal. You can get lifetime membership, all 25 languages, for 50% off. Don't put off learning that new language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, History of Persia listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today. Since he had the signet ring, Perdiccas had the singular unlucky job of trying to corral all the highest-ranking nobles into making decisions from his position sitting in the throne that once belonged to Alexander, which in turn had been inherited from the Achaemenids, and it must have felt like an awfully big seat to fill. Perdiccas declared that they should make arrangements for their first true imperial funeral to general agreement, but then he proposed discussing the succession. And these are the words that Curtius puts in his mouth. "Fellow soldiers, we need a leader. Whether that should be one man or more is up to you, but you must realize an army of soldiers without any leader is a body without a soul. This is the sixth month of Roxane's pregnancy. We pray that she gives birth to a boy who will assume the throne when he comes of age with the blessing of the gods. Until then, you must decide how many leaders you want and who that should be." Nearchus was the first to speak. He declared that only Alexander's bloodline could possibly inherit the throne and suggested that rather than waiting to see if Alexander would have a son by Roxane, they install Heracles, Alexander's supposed illegitimate son by Barsine. Never mind that Heracles' actual parentage was extremely dubious, didn't fit the timeline of events, and that the boy was now Nearchus' stepson. As Curtius puts it, nobody liked Nearchus' suggestion, end quote. Ptolemy then broke through the clamoring voices to go on a sarcastic tirade about how, regardless of their father, no son of Roxane and Barsine could be accepted in Macedon and Greece, which would view half-Iranian kings as the inheritors of Darius and Xerxes rather than Alexander. He proposed appointing nobody, leaving the throne empty and governing as a council of Alexander's favored generals and advisors, just as they were doing in that moment. That could plausibly work for the short term, but it wasn't exactly a great plan for generational success. So the debate raged on. Leonatus, another officer and close friend of Perdiccas, suggested that since Alexander said "to the strongest" and gave Perdiccas his ring, that they should interpret this as naming Perdiccas heir, but Perdiccas refused that nomination outright. The general Meleager broke in at this point and declared that even Perdiccas presiding over this council was unbecoming of a noble, because simply holding a ring gave him no right to rule as regent. Meleager said that they could not truly make a decision until Roxane's child was born. If it were a son, they'd have a clear next step: choose a regent until Alexander's rightful heir came of age. If it were a daughter, they could just revisit this debate at that time. But by taking a stance against the existence of this council in the first place, Meleager had somewhat inadvertently driven the crowd inside the throne room towards a riot. A low-ranking Macedonian soldier who had pressed in through the crowd outside started shouting out in favor of Aridaeus, Alexander's elder half-brother, who was a living legitimate heir to the throne. This man argued that they would never find an equal to replace Alexander, but Aridaeus had the best claim by every Macedonian precedent. Based on Curtius's version of the story, you do feel a bit bad for Aridaeus here, because the room fell silent for a moment before many of the commoners started demanding Aridaeus be brought into the council. It sounds a bit like everyone kinda forgot that the poor guy even existed. Unfortunately, this also escalated to the lowly soldiers calling all of the presiding officers traitors and demanding their executions, which only pushed everyone closer to a riot. Pathon, one of Alexander's bodyguards, began speaking out against Aridaeus and in favor of an interim government until Roxane's child was born, bringing more and more people around to this idea. But now reminded of Aridaeus, Meleager stormed off, found the prince and a few other men, and they hailed Aridaeus as King Philip III, though history remembers him better as Philip Aridaeus. Back near the throne, Pathon was leading the assembly through a plan to divvy up responsibilities between the highest officers and swear an oath of allegiance to Alexander's unborn son. But then Meleager stormed into the chamber with Philip Aridaeus in tow and declared that the assembly of officers were all traitors, throwing everyone back into disarray, and by disarray, I obviously mean the brink of civil war. Through all of these episodes on Alexander, we've heard the low hum of a Macedonian traditionalist streak among the infantry, often among the first who would resist Alexander's drive to travel further east or adopt Persian customs, and so on. Well, many of these phalangites agreed with Meleager. Macedonian precedent was clear. Philip Aridaeus was the logical heir to the throne, so they took up arms, got into formation, and were led by Meleager himself wearing hastily assembled armor in a parade around the palace grounds, proclaiming Philip as king. Perdiccas responded by ordering the chamber with Alexander's body still lying in it locked and put under guard, including 600 veterans likely from Alexander's hypospists and the cavalry, as well as Ptolemy leading a, quote, company of royal boys, the children who acted as pages and servants at arms for the nobles, as well as messengers and other low functionaries for the Macedonian court. They were the young sons of the nobility. But there were at least 1,000 soldiers following Meleager and Philip now, and they just knocked down the locked doors to seize Alexander's body as a symbol of their legitimacy. Perdiccas called on the mutineers to abandon Philip and defend Alexander's corpse, prompting an indoor javelin battle as spears flew through the air inside the palace between both sides. Veteran soldiers on the pro-Philip camp pushed their way into the middle and pleaded with Perdiccas to stand aside and acknowledge the king to avert further bloodshed, because his side was just too outnumbered to survive a battle. Perdiccas and the anti-Philip group did lay down their arms, but they ran right out of the palace and then out of Babylon altogether, rallying with the cavalry at an impromptu war camp in the plains outside the city. What had begun as a debate between nobles was rapidly escalating toward a Macedonian class war. The cavalry were largely pulled from the nobles, and they had already integrated with Iranian horsemen, unlike the infantry, who were generally from the lower classes, and had yet to fully merge with Alexander's phalanx of Persians. So you have lower-class, traditionalist infantry supporting Philip Aridaeus and Meleager, while noble, Medizing cavalry supported Perdiccas and tentatively Roxane's unborn child. This created a terrifying scenario for the people in and around Babylon. The ordinary Mesopotamians and settlers who actually lived their lives here instead of viewing the city as a political prize. Perdiccas and the cavalry were now outside, and they instituted a de facto siege by refusing to allow merchants and supplies into the city. This caused the people of Babylon to consider fleeing into the countryside before the situation could escalate. At the same time, the denizens of the outer city and the surrounding farmland worried that Perdiccas' forces would raid their homes and farms, and began fleeing to the safety behind Babylon's walls. Fearing a riot, or worse, widespread peasant revolt, Meleager and Philip started sending messengers to negotiate with Perdiccas. I think Perdiccas understood the score, or at least understood Philip better than Meleager could in that moment. His demands were simple. Meleager and the military leaders on his side were at fault, not Aridaeus or his supporters in the infantry. The latter would obey their chosen king, and Perdiccas would not harm Aridaeus if he surrendered. Philip III Aridaeus chose to relinquish power and avert a civil war, at least for the time being, agreeing to Perdiccas' terms and removing his diadem. Publicly, Perdiccas and Meleager became equal partners, taking control of the cavalry and infantry respectively for a formal ceremony of religious reunification. Privately, Perdiccas and Philip Aridaeus conspired together to take out Meleager. During the ceremony, Philip openly called for Meleager's arrest and execution alongside the 300 men who had led the attack to steal Alexander's body. Those 300 mutineers were bound and trampled by war elephants, while Meleager fled to a temple inside the city for sanctuary. Unfortunately for him, the local priests wanted nothing to do with this fight and handed him over to the first of Perdiccas' men who came looking. They then summarily executed the would-be kingmaker. Perdiccas reconvened the council to decide the succession, and oddly enough, everyone was a lot more compliant after a near brush with civil war and watching 300 men ground into paste by elephant hooves. However, it was also clear that some reconciliation was still needed. Philip Aridaeus had proven a popular candidate, and as an adult, his popularity would be a threat to Roxane and Alexander's unborn heir. So they declared that Philip III would indeed be king, and rule as co-monarch if Roxane gave birth to a son. That would at least give them a couple decades to sort things out completely. They also seized the opportunity to reconfigure the leadership of the empire and its satrapies. At this point, Alexander had shuffled his governors around so many times that the only real rule for who was in charge of where was that each man was loyal to Alexander himself and not needed in the conquering army. However, with Alexander dead and internal tensions at an all-time high, everyone recognized that their conquering days were done. So the leading nobles and generals would now rule as satraps. Philip Aridaeus' major satraps would be Ptolemy in Egypt and Libya, Laomedon, one of the last veterans of Philip II's wars, would govern Syria and the Levant, Philotas, a distinguished officer, was given Cilicia, Antigonus Monophthalmos in Lycia and Greater Phrygia, Cassander in Caria, Menander, commander of the Greek mercenaries in Lydia, Leonatus, Perdiccas' second-in-command in Hellespontine Phrygia, Eumenes of Cardia in Cappadocia, and Paphlagonia, now split off from Phrygia altogether, Pathon in Media, and Lysimachus in Thrace. The Eastern, or as they were often called in Greek literature after this point, Upper Satrapies, were all left with their existing governors. Perdiccas himself took up a position as Philip's primary advisor and de facto regent. That's a lot of names and places, but hopefully you noticed some interesting choices. Many of those appointments make sense on the surface, with prominent leaders taking prominent satrapies. However, others, like putting Antigonus in Greater Phrygia and the relatively unknown Menander in wealthy and powerful Lydia, do stand out. Well-secured but powerful provinces went to less influential commanders, while less powerful satrapies went to very influential officers. This was a way of striking a balance of power between the most dangerous men in the empire. The partial exceptions come in places that were most at risk of facing native rebellions, like Egypt and Cappadocia. In fact, one of Eumenes' first tasks in his new assignment was to defeat Ariothres, the Persian satrap of Cappadocia who was still resisting the Macedonian conquest. You can also see how these Greeks and Macedonians still prioritized the familiar regions near Greece itself and just kind of shrugged and left the East untouched. As they saw it, future conflict and competition for their people would still be centered on the Mediterranean, and they all wanted their slice of that pie. The upper satrapies just didn't have the same allure for the generals as they had for Alexander. The exception seems to be putting Pathon in Media, where they took this as an opportunity to remove Atropates, one of the last Achaemenid satraps still in power in his original satrapy under Macedonian rule, a decision which would come back to haunt at least Pathon. With that, the empire was at rest for the moment, really for the first time since Alexander had invaded 11 years earlier. But that still left the issue of Alexander's body and funeral to attend to. According to Curtius, a full week passed with the body just lying there in the palace under the sweltering heat of the Middle Eastern summer. Yet, miraculously, Alexander's divine heritage was so great that no decay would set in, and his body was still in pristine condition despite days of neglect. Dr. Catherine Hall of the Dunedin School of Medicine has suggested possibly the most disturbing explanation for Curtius's story. Alexander wasn't dead. In 2019, Dr. Hall proposed that Alexander suffered from Guillain-Barré syndrome, a bacterial infection that leads to autoimmune disorder resulting in paralysis. Standard Greek medical doctrine in antiquity was to check for breathing rather than a pulse, and in a paralyzed state, breathing can be too shallow to identify. The gruesome part comes with the suggestion that 7 days later, Alexander was still alive when he was taken away to be embalmed. The thing is, that would be 7 whole days without food or water in an already perilous, diseased state that medicine at the time could not possibly have saved him from. Maybe he wasn't dead on the 11th of June after all, but he probably would still have been dead by the 18th. It's also entirely likely that this story is just made up, and Alexander was in fact starting to fester by the time Perdiccas got around to dealing with his body. Many theories have been put forward to explain Alexander's death at just 33. One popular theory in antiquity was that Antipater, still acting as regent in Macedon, had him poisoned. Sure, that's possible. The motives are a bit weak, and the symptoms described in ancient sources could also just point to basically anything. As the story goes, Alexander fell ill after a night of heavy drinking, woke up with aches and pains all over, and went to the classic hangover cure of a morning of heavy drinking. That escalated to debilitating pain and rising fever until he could barely speak or move his limbs. Like I said, could be poison, could be GBS. It could also be malaria, common enough in that region even today. His symptoms are consistent with so many infections and viruses and chronic illnesses, including many associated with rampant alcoholism, that they're not even worth listing. Historians, doctors, biologists, and hobbyists have all enjoyed putting forward a new idea every few years. But we're also talking about a man who had been impaled, wandered through the scorching desert, nearly had his throat cut, almost died of shock and hypothermia in a river, been knocked from his horse, and surely suffered a wide array of other minor battlefield injuries on top of chronic alcoholism and feasting in the 4th century BCE. It's probably easier to rule out the things that didn't contribute to his death. It's really a very silly branch of speculative history, fueled more by Alexander's ability to grab headlines than anything of actual importance. The king is dead, and he has more than earned my patented royal death treatment. So next time, we discuss religion. But in this new phase of history, it's high time we talk about a whole new set of gods. And with that, the age of Alexander comes to an end, as does the Achaemenid era. Alexander had carried on many Achaemenid traditions and clearly focused on ruling the Achaemenid Empire as conquered territory. However, with his death, his diadochoi, the Greek word for successors, shifted their focus toward the looming struggle for power with Perdiccas, King Philip Aradaeus, and the pregnant Queen Roxane all headed for Macedon. And Greek and Macedonian governors controlled most of West Asia. This is the dawning of the so-called Hellenistic Age, and the next major chapter in the history of Persia.